to address hepatitis C and HIV, the syndemic of that and other infectious diseases and STIs in our community. It's a really critical program, and right now our funding remains in place for that. But you know, there's a lot of anxiety that people have in relationship to the discussions about what the administration may or may not do to cut Indian Health Service's support. Will be impacted probably as well, not in the same way that an IHS designated facility would be. You know, I also want to take the moment here to sort of make people aware, like what we are paying for by cutting healthcare services and Medicare and Medicaid, those decisions that they're making is to be able to afford to give even deeper and longer tax breaks to the top 1% of the wealthiest people in the United States. We're trading the health of a very large sector of the United States population and prioritizing the wealth of a very small number of people. Since Obama's administration and the ACA and Medicaid expansion in Minnesota, the number of Native people who were uncovered for any healthcare insurance significantly dipped. Maybe 55% of Native people covered for health insurance in the state of Minnesota go up to like as high as 75-80%. We know just from patient care and other healthcare research that people who are not insured, don't have health insurance, they're going to put off their healthcare for longer periods of time. They won't seek healthcare until something urgent arises. And so I think individually and in our families and in our communities and, you know, writ large as a society, when we have these conversations, we have to be really clear about what we're trading. But I think that Native people know the importance of health, well-being, and balance, and being in harmony with one another, in harmony with the things that are around us, and being in harmony with our mind, body, and our spirits. NAC and the other organizations like ours that are committed to providing healthcare services to the people who rely on this safety net, we're going to continue to do this work until we can't do it. We will find the resources to do it. I am making all of my decisions as the leader of this organization from a place of strength and courage. I'm not operating out of fear. I think about the things that our ancestors had to overcome and contend with. Our ancestors worked hard. They gave up their blood, their sweat, and their tears for us to have the things that we have. I mean, the fight ain't over yet. So
that's all for this week's episode. Join us next time for more voices and stories that inform, uplift, and shape our communities right here on Minnesota Native News. Minnesota Native News is produced by AMPERS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
Bonjour, welcome to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. I'm your host, Cole Primo. Today, we're revisiting our chat with Karina Berry, a citizen of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. Karina manages the organizing, policy, and advocacy direct action arm of Endian Collective, which in January of 2025 led the successful campaign to free Leonard Peltier from prison. She divides her creative energies between metal fabrication and sewing. She talks about how her role as a mother to a young daughter helps train her energies on creating a better world for the next generation. She also discusses how her childbirth experience led her to seek out training as a doula to help Indigenous mothers impacted by the medical system. We spoke with Karina Berry in March of 2025. Enjoy.
There's been 5 decades of organizing and advocacy around Leonard's freedom. But Andean Collective's like formal campaign, we really like dug in deep about 3 years ago. And last June, he got denied for parole again. And then when he was denied that, we knew our next pathway was executive clemency through the Biden administration.
Buju, hello, welcome to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. I'm your host, Leah Lam.
And I'm your other host, Cole Primo. Mi Gwech for joining us today. Native Lights is more than a podcast and radio show. At its core, it's a place for Native folks to tell their stories. Each and every week, we have captivating conversations with
great guests from a whole lot of different backgrounds. We're talking musicians, community leaders, healthcare advocates, doctors, language warriors, you name it. They have a wonderful mix of passions, and we talk to them about their gifts and how they share those gifts with their community. And it all centers around the big point of purpose in our lives. And I can't wait to continue amplifying Native Voices. Leah, how's it going? What's up?
Hey, things are going well over here. You know, we have our puppy, Radagast. He's doing wonderful. He's like twice the weight he was when we first got him a month and a half ago. Went from 15 pounds to 30 pounds.
Sure.
I struggle to pick him up now.
Radagast. That rascal.
But he's very cute. How about you?
Going well. It's going well. I don't know if I've officially announced it yet, but Maria, my wife and I are expecting.
What?
I've told you. Come on.
Wouldn't that be funny if you told me on this program?
Oh, yeah. That would be great. Just to get the reaction. Yeah. No, it's been great. We're due in August, early August. And so just about 20 weeks right now. So we're doing that big ultrasound deal here soon. So that's going to be fun to see all that. So we're very excited. And the old kid has started kicking already. So it's been, that's been an interesting thing to witness and to be a part of.
Aww.
It's obviously stressful, but I'm also very thankful. So ready to rock.
I'm super excited to talk to our guest today, Karina Barry. Karina is a citizen of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. She's a mother, organizer, doula, novice sewer, and metal fabricator in training. Gotta ask her about that. She also works at NDN Collective, managing the organizing, policy and advocacy, and direct action arm. Really excited to have Karina here today. Bonjour, Karina. How are you?
Hi, bonjour.
Bonjour, Karina. Could you start by introducing yourself and telling us where you're joining us from?
Yeah, bonjour, Cole. Bonjour, Leah. My name is Karina Barry. Wabaninude Nikwe, Dijinakaj. Your East Wind Woman is my spirit name. I am Leech Lake Anishinaabe, calling in from St. Paul, Minnesota, where I live with my little family and work from home. Was a lifelong like Southsider Minneapolis kid, and we crossed the river recently, and we're getting used to it. It's nice over here, so but yeah, doing good.
How are you in the family? I was a toddler. How's that, all that?
Yeah, well, honestly, we're going on our fourth week of viruses and sickness and bugs, so we're hanging in there. I think having a toddler, a daycare age kiddo, they're always bringing the good germs and buggies back home. And then it just, I know like sickness has just kind of been all around and impacting folks. So we've been doing our best to kind of stay healthy, keep our energy up, not feel too wonky, kind of being in the house a lot. But seeing the sun come out and feeling some warmer weather has been really helpful, I think, in seeing the light on the other side of this. Probably the most sickly winter we've had. I don't know. It's just been a weird winter in that way.
In the intro, I was talking about how my wife Maria and I, we are expecting our first child here in August, and my immune system is already terrible to begin with, and I can't imagine how many colds and all that stuff I'm going to get. So if you have any tips.
Yeah, totally inevitable, but congratulations also. And it's beautiful, and yeah, lots of boogies and germs. And you know, it's like we always have to remind ourselves when she's like eating something weird or like touching gross stuff, you're like, you know what, she's building that immune system. It might not be building ours, but it's building hers, so maybe she gets less sick. But yeah, I think just stay up on your vitamins, you know, it's the best you can do.
There you go. Well noted.
Well, Karina, we usually like to ask our guests what you are concentrating on or thinking about these days.
A constant for me is thinking about like preparedness and yeah, like what that means for skill building and learning for like the end of the world, or maybe what true liberation is kind of like my reframe of it. And so, you know, even in this like larger political climate, it's always an important time to like deepen relationships, you know, with loved ones, with trusted people. And so I think leaning into that a lot more, especially in these sort of like heavier kind of challenging times, but also identifying those like opportunities where we're like, okay, are we planting our gardens and learning from each other about like what kind of foods we want to grow and leaning into those caring connections and caring relationships, but also like learning like skills and things that will help sustain us.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know it's on our list of things to ask you. Metal fabrication. You're a metal fabricator in training. That's what I saw in your bio. And I wrote down, what is that?
It's actually been like 5 years in the making, but it wasn't originally the intention. So 2019, I connected with the nonprofit We Are All Criminals, and they do a lot of work around humanizing folks who are incarcerated, overrepresented in carceral systems, and also creating a platform for artists who are on the inside to share their poetry, their various forms of art. And it was a project called Seen, like for them to be like seen, heard, you know, valued. And we were supposed to have an exhibit at the Wiseman in 2020, you know, then all happens in the world. And so that got pushed off and kept getting pushed off. The premise of the project is to connect an inside artist with an outside artist or community collaborator. And I have never thought of myself as an artist or like artsy creative in any way. So I remember when we first started this, you know, I'm like, oh, I'm a social worker and I don't have like, what am I going to do? But it was really beautiful because like even through the delays, it just pushed me and Jeff, who is my partner on the project. We would do like podcast recordings where like he would call on, you know, with his like limited 15 minutes of prison phone calls. And we would just like talk about topics of healing, topics of trauma. And then like, what does that look like across Indigenous and Black communities? And like our conversations would just like get deeper and deeper and more vast. As we got closer to like this exhibit coming to life or like, what are we going to do for our section? We talked about, I guess, like epigenetics and blood memory in our conversations. So we came up with the idea of getting a helix fabricated, like a DNA helix. And then we wanted to like have words engraved in it on one side that represented like harm, like patriarchy, you know, colonization, prisons, you know, just kind of all these different words. And then on the other side, we'd wrap in sweetgrass because we also talked about like medicines as healing practices. And we talked about the book Braiding Sweetgrass because that was like, I feel like newly popular or becoming more popular in discussion. And so originally we were going to hire someone to do that fabrication. And then I woke up one day and I was like, you know what? I feel like I want to learn to do that. I feel like it will help me feel a different level of connection to the project and push me to do something really uncomfortable because I've never done any like sculpture work, I don't paint, I don't draw, you know, and definitely have never done metal work. And so I ended up connecting with Chicago Fire Arts Center, which is located in George Floyd Square in South Minneapolis. And Heather Doyle is one of the staff and leadership folks over there. And she was amazing. And she just like really helped me map out a process that was accessible and helping me figure out how to purchase copper and then like the process of cutting the copper, then the process of like bending it and turning it and then ultimately welding it into that helix. And then now fast forward, the scene at Wiseman has been open. The exhibit's been open since February and is open until May. So yeah, so that's why like, it kind of like, it's like a joke, but also like I'm a metal fabricator training because it's like this push to, it was for this project, but now that that exhibit is open, I don't know that I'll make more sculptures, but I definitely have like curiosity of like, okay, what can I do with this, I don't know, new skill? And it's like kind of scary and intimidating. So like, how do I keep learning and becoming more safe in my understanding of it too?
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, we're revisiting our chat with Karina Berry, a citizen of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, who manages the organizing, policy, and advocacy direct action arm of Indian Collective.
You also mentioned getting into doula work. What inspired you to do that?
I think, you know, getting pregnant, becoming a mom, and like my own experience as like an Indigenous mother and kind of going through that process of pregnancy and the realities of like navigating like Western medical systems. And I had this whole birth plan of utilizing a birthing center, which is like more like home birth feels, you know, like much more fluid. You bring in your medicines, any like cultural practices you want, right? And all was going well up until I was 36 weeks, and then everything changed, and then it turned into like a more high risk of infection, and I needed to go to the hospital, navigate labor and delivery there. I've had all this like hospital trauma from like previous life experiences, and I just remember like the grief, the fear of flooding over me in that like moment when they're like, you have to go to the hospital now and transition from this place. And the reality is like, that's true for so many Indigenous women. Like we have some of the worst disproportionality for maternal health for Indigenous women and Black women in the state of Minnesota. And there's been some reports that have come out in the recent years that really dig deeper into that. And for myself, I saw this opportunity. There's this full spectrum Indigenous doula training program called Zagaduin. And they're two trainers, Indigenous women out of Canada across the medicine line. They were coming to Minneapolis. And so I just happened to see it, you know, on Facebook. I feel like I love when the algorithms and social media work can throw you something cool. And I saw like this opportunity. And of course, I'm like, oh, I work full time and I have all these things. How am I going to do this like doula training? But I just leaned in and I made it work. And that was just kind of like the starting point, I think, of like, how do I take my lived experience navigating this, but then bring this into this context of this Indigenized birth worker curriculum. Like it was really beautiful, like all these components around pregnancy, prenatal care, to labor and delivery, and to our teachings around how we welcome little ones into the world, and then like postpartum care. I also like had a really hard time with postpartum depression and anxiety. So I think being able to learn new teachings, new techniques, and learn with other Indigenous women that participated in that cohort, it gave me a lot of life. I don't know, like I felt this energy shift in my body and my spirit. And so I was really thankful that I did it. And then it was kind of been slow of like taking the time, like as mothers or sort of clients are becoming available, like, is it the right fit? Because I do work full time. I have a toddler of my own. So it's like sometimes moms need more support, you know, more higher needs. And that's amazing. But I'm like more on the like, okay, still like learning going into this. I want to be like really intentional about the reality of like what kind of support I can provide a mom. So I'm working with a mom now. And so it'll actually be my first like birth, you know, since completing the program in the last year. She's due in the next couple months. And so it's been really nice to like connect with community members in like a very different way.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. Thank you. Can you tell me a bit about your current work at Indian Collective?
Yeah, I mean, I think just like at the foundational level, we're not about reforming systems and investing in these systems and structures that oppress and harm our people and that have for hundreds of years. Like we're about investing in Indigenous-led solutions and changing the conditions in which we live and navigate. And so for Indian Collective, you know, over the last 5 years, like we've, instead of, you know, just focusing in and struggling in this fight of like, you know, South Dakota is like ground zero for like Native students in the education system. And instead of spending all of our energy trying to reform like South Dakota education and schools, we founded and opened our own school in the Ocheti Shakoin Community Academy, opened, gosh, maybe going on 3 years ago, where they're able to start from the ground of like, okay, what do we know is wrong with the existing educational system in our schools? And how do we build and change the condition in which we know our, you know, our Native students deserve to feel, to be seen, to be heard, to have culture and language and teachings threaded out through the entirety of the curriculum, not just a language class or a cultural class. Like the whole school is just like embedded in that sort of pedagogy or like that approach to education. And so that's like an example of, I think, that shift. You know, I think other examples too are we have purchased land and could community development work. And so I feel like a lot of people see land back and recognize NDN for like our narrative use and our swag and kind of like promotional things around land back. But it's not just like this phrase, it's this meta narrative for everything. Like we, you know, we see everything that we're doing ties back into land back. So it's like that connection to our culture, our language, our foodways, you know, our grant making and investing into relatives that are doing food sovereignty work or creating economies around like their buffalo or their salmon or whatever it might be. Like that's land back, you know what I mean? Or, you know, we purchased 60 plus acres in Rapid City to build that school long term. Like there's a temporary site, but to build a school, but also like in addressing like the housing crisis, building our own multi-use housing units, creating space for Indigenous businesses, creating an Indian center. Like we're fortunate to have the Minneapolis American Indian Center. So like that's an example there of like nothing like that exists. And so like we're going to create it. And so I think that is what's different about Indian is there's not this like operating in scarcity, feeling tied to and restricted by like federal or state funding and grants, because that's like hardly any of our funding, you know. Our development team, our president, Nick Tosin, they really have set this sort of standard of how they approach philanthropy and their expectations and ask from funders. And like, we're not going to accept funds or, you know, any resources that are going to restrict us in that way. Like, we're going to do this in the way that we know will uplift our people and like really lean into like Indigenous led, you know, like I said, solutions. How do we create something of our own or invest in what we know that works versus like exhausting ourselves, kind of doing the same thing and trying to stay within like the status quo?
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, we're revisiting our chat with Karina Berry, a citizen of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, who manages the organizing, policy, and advocacy direct action arm of Indian Collective.
And one of the big efforts recently was the Free Leonard Peltier effort. I saw you in that press conference and I had to shout it out a little bit. What was it like being a part of that effort?
Oh boy. Well, I feel like I'm still processing in many ways. Like it was truly a life-changing moment, a campaign, an effort to be a part of. There's been 5 decades of organizing and advocacy around Leonard's freedom. Some of our team members that worked on Indians campaign, you know, had been doing that advocacy too, is since they were a little one, you know, or in their teenage years, you know, have been organizing around this for many years. But Indian Collective's like formal campaign, we really like dug in deep about 3 years ago. And it was like a heavy, like political advocacy campaign. It's because he's been unjustly imprisoned for 50 years and he continues to get denied parole. And so last June, he got denied for parole again. And so that was like this, you know, this moment of like sadness, because it's what Leonard will say. And he said in that press conference too, is like, they gave him a death sentence when they denied him parole, because he wouldn't be eligible for a parole hearing for another 15 years. He's 80 years old and he has like very serious like health conditions and needs that have been unmet for, you know, going on 50 years. And so he's just like, I'm not going to live, like I'm going to die in here. And for us, it just, I don't know, it really made us grind harder. We're like, okay, how do we pivot? You know, we pivoted from 2.5 years of advocacy around getting Leonard granted parole. And then when he was denied that, we knew our next pathway was executive clemency through the Biden administration. And so then there was a lot of intentional meetings and conversations at all levels, you know, with Secretary Deb Haaland and different people of like, how do we get into Biden's ear and how do we, you know, make ripples and keep Leonard's name in the media, in the narrative to push for his freedom. And so that's what we did. You know, fast forward to like it was like a 3-month sprint, it felt like, from the end of 2024 until Inauguration Day, Biden's last day in office, where we're just like pushing and pushing with tribal leaders and getting into every ear we can in the White House, while also in the background preparing a home for Leonard. You know, Indian purchased a home even before his parole hearing. It's like, for folks that know anything about relatives who are incarcerated and coming home, there's this process of like reentry, right? And there's not a well-supported reentry often. There are, you know, a lot of efforts to improve that. And so for Leonard, in his parole packet, like we needed to have it be as strong as we could. And so it's like, he needs a home to go to. And so like purchased his house in Turtle Mountain in his homelands so that he had that safe and soft landing to return to. So like while we're at, you know,
digging deep in all this like visible advocacy, like we're behind the scenes, like renovating a house and, you know, like getting it ready for him. And so there's just so many intricate details, even up to in those final hours of Biden's administration and time as president, we're refreshing the White House website as he's like releasing, you know, pardons and, you know, like his last ditch efforts of executive orders. And it was the last order he signed and put out. So within minutes, you know, those last minutes of like him signing out and Trump signing in, and he did it, we refreshed and we were just like, oh my God, you know, because we just like, we prayed like through this whole process. We did ceremony after ceremony, we prayed and we had hope. But, you know, after 5 decades of this, there's definitely that feeling of like, is this the last chance? You know, is Biden going to do this? Like, there wasn't never 100% he's going to do it. And so when it happened, you know, we were like, oh my God. And, you know, we had a team on the ground in Florida with our hopes that, you know, by some miracle, he could get released right away. But the order, you know, gave an extra 30 days. So he was released on February 18th. So that shifted us to, yeah, working on all the intricate details of coordinating transportation to get him home safely. Like, we're deeply concerned about his safety. Even still, you know, the FBI came out very publicly up in those final moments to framing him up, you know, leaning in this narrative of him being this like murderous, you know, malicious, like danger to the public as this 80-year-old elder who, you know, is still stands by his innocence. And so that fear of like what could happen to him, and then also just like, you know, agitators, folks that were upset with the decision. So like, we were having to like create security plans and get security in place, coordinating the plane that was going to bring him to North Dakota, having a medical team, having an RN and staffing that flight to make sure he was okay. Like, there was all these medical conversations too of like, one, he's going to like go from whatever warm climate in Florida to, it was like 50 below, I feel like, in North Dakota that week, and then add in his health issues. And then on the other side, like preparing for his welcoming home. And like, I was lead on like the logistics for sort of the North Dakota side in that way. And it, you know, it was an adventure because it's like, I'm not from Turtle Mountain. Like, North Dakota is not my home community. So, it, you know, it's really pushing us to like dig in deep and build those relationships within tribal leadership there and community members around like, what does a welcoming for Leonard look like? And so we planned, it was just a community event is what we called it, but which is what folks saw as sort of like a press conference where we had over 300 people. Like, that room was packed at Skydancer Casino and Hotel in Belcourt, North Dakota, waiting for Leonard to come in that day. And there was like this really beautiful, like grand entry moment where dancers and singers like brought him in, and just like everyone just kind of goes wild, and the surreal moment of him walking into this space and folks being able to see him. Yeah. And then that's kind of where it turned into like a space, like Leonard has really been clear, like he wants to tell his own story, you know? And so we've been really intentional to not tell his story for him, to share what has already been shared and what he wants to share. So like really leaning in on consent, respecting sort of those boundaries for him, and also trying to help coordinate those spaces, you know, those interviews, really helping vet media, because there's a lot of like predatory media and other people too trying to get access to him. And so there was just a lot of intention in like that media strategy as well to help create space for him. Yeah, to share with his own voice, like, what does this mean? What does this feel like to be home? And then also for him to be able to spend the time over the coming months and years, like telling more about his side of the story, which has gone unheard, you know, for the last 50 years. There's so many details that I could share that we don't have time for, but I think a highlight, of course, is like seeing the plane land and welcoming Leonard off, but then also like just going to his house and meal prepping some food for him, you know, cooking up some chicken and some vegetables, some healthy food. And then like having my daughter, like, you know, be able to like meet him and him to be like, I'm grandpa, you know, and just like this moment of, we're all just relatives. And like, this is our elder, you know, this is this political prisoner, this key figure in our many of our communities and our history. And then to have him be home and then just like spend casual time with him and just
see how funny and chill and just like sweet he is, and then also like just to see him navigate this whole new world of like figuring out a smartphone and like a smart TV, you know, like these all these little details that are just like a learning process for him. This is really amazing, and that's why I say like still processing, because there was just so many different pieces a part of like that story of like him coming home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a historical moment, and I can tell that you have